I'm with Sriram Panchu, a senior advocate at the Madras High Court and the Supreme Court, an internationally recognized mediator and arbitrator. And today we're talking about this very serious issue that has erupted these last few days, in fact, these last few weeks, over the pros and cons of a controversy around the Gyanvapi Mosque, a mosque in Banaras, in Varanasi. The mosque was built by Aurangzeb, having destroyed the Kashi Vishwanath temple that was right next to it, adjacent to it. Anybody who's been to Banaras knows that, that these two monuments are cheek by jowl. But the controversy that has erupted and that has, and the whole country's agog with this, is that the that there are petitions in front of a local court in Banaras. And now this matter has reached the Supreme Court as well. It will be it will come before the bench of Justice Chandrachud and Justice Narasimha on Friday. And to explain this very sort of controversial matter, I'd like to ask Mr. Panchu. But first of all, Mr. Panchu, I'd like to welcome you to the print. So welcome.
Thank you, Jyoti. Pleasure to be here. Thank you.
So just explain to us, first of all, and let me add that you were very much involved in the mediation around the Ayodhya Ram Janmabhoomi dispute that was successfully concluded in 2019, when 2.77 acres of the disputed land was given to the Hindu side. And in exchange for that, 5 acres of land outside the disputed area was given to the Muslim side. But explain to me what's happening today and why this has become such huge controversy around the Gyanvapi Mosque.
Right. Jyoti, what I'm going to do is this. I'm going to try and focus on something which is deeper and broader than the current issue in controversy. Because I think there needs to be a great deal of public education on this deeper aspects. And I think that will help to place things in perspective.
Okay.
Will help to show the way forward. And will, I think, make it clear that the law in this country and the judgments of the Supreme Court really serve to obviate and prevent controversies such as this. Mm-hmm. So let me tell you, first of all, and I know this because I come from, you know, the background of having dealt with Ayodhya for close to 9 months, 3 years back. Firstly, the Ram Mandir in Ayodhya is very different from the other places in controversy. And the singular difference is this, that there was a pre-existing litigation there, which was started many, many years back. And apart from that, I think the difference is that in Ayodhya, there was no temple for Ram, and there was an agitation for a temple for Ram. The difference between that and Kashi is that in Kashi, as you said, there was a demolition of a temple and a mosque was constructed. But the important point is that way back in the 1800s, Ahilya Bai Holkar constructed the current Kashi Vishwanath temple. This is way back in the 1800s.
Right.
From the 1900s, Kashi Vishwanath, the present temple, has established itself as a center for Hindu pilgrimage in the area. Mm-hmm. That is really the stark difference between these two cases. Now, let me take you to an enactment called the Places of Worship Special Provisions Act 1991.
I'm so sorry to interrupt you, Mr. Panchu, but you said earlier that in the Ram Mandir matter, there was a pre-existing legislation. Are you talking about when India becomes independent in 1947? That's when this has been extant since then?
Yeah. So let me explain what I meant by, not really pre-existing litigation, but a pre-existing case.
Yeah.
And I'm referring to a legislation called the Places of Worship Special Provisions Act 1991.
Right.
And this came about at the time of the, you know, about at the time around the demolition of the Babri Masjid.
Yeah.
And in the wake of that, Parliament passed this act. It's a simple act.
No, but the Babri Masjid was demolished in 1992. So this predates the demolition.
It does. But the litigation in respect of that had started earlier.
Okay.
So this act does one thing. It basically says it's an act to prohibit conversion of any place of worship and to provide for the maintenance of the religious character of any place of worship as it existed on the 15th day of August 1947. Mm-hmm. Section 3, bar of conversion of places of worship. No person shall convert any place of worship of any religious denomination or any section thereof into a place of worship of a different section of the same religious denomination or of a different religious denomination or any section thereof. It's okay. A simple bar. You cannot change the character of any temple, mosque, church, gurdwara, or what have you. The only exception the Act made was for the Ram Mandir.
Mm-hmm.
Because it was an existing litigation and contention. That is the only exception, stated exception in the Act. Other than that, the Act applies to every place of worship as it existed as of 1947.
So in 1947, when India becomes independent, the Ram Mandir dispute was already extant.
The Act, I think, took note of the extensive litigation and controversy around the Ram Mandir and said, we'll leave this out.
Okay.
Because there's too much of controversy around it, we'll leave it out. But as far as all other places of religion, there is a bar against conversion.
So today at the Gyanvapi or tomorrow in Mathura, because by the way, the local courts in Mathura have accepted an application, a petition, which says that the Mandir should be returned to the Hindu community. Now, what is going on?
So let me tell you again. So here is this act. And then the next point I want to make is the Ayodhya judgment. Now, in the Ayodhya judgment, the Supreme Court did one very important thing. This act is a piece of parliamentary legislation.
Mm-hmm.
Any parliamentary legislation as it is can be altered or amended.
Right.
The Supreme Court did one very significant thing in the Ayodhya judgment to allay the fears of minority communities. And what the Supreme Court did was to say that we will elevate this act to the status of being part of the basic structure of the Constitution.
Okay, what does that mean?
Yes, now the basic structure of the Constitution is a doctrine laid down in Keshav Nand Bharti's case, which goes back to 1973. In that case, the issue was, can Parliament amend fundamental rights?
Mm-hmm.
And the court reached a halfway house judgment, where it said, Parliament may amend the fundamental rights, but Parliament cannot touch the basic structure of the Constitution. And they earmarked certain things we placed in the basic structure and said we may also add to it in future. So those are like, you know, the right of judicial redress, certain fundamental rights, the right against arbitrary arrest and detention, things which are as secularism, things which are basic for the structure of this country as a functioning democracy and as a multicultural, multi-religious country. And they said these form part. I'm going to read you Justice Jeevan Reddy's judgment on that.
So now in 2019, when the Supreme Court gave this judgment, it took this and it put it into the basic structure of the Constitution. Right. It added it to the basic structure.
That's right. And I'm going to read that for you and you read on your listeners.
Okay.
The court sets out the act. It sets out the intention of Parliament. And I'm going to read the Home Minister S.P. Chavan's statement on the floor of the House. He said, we see this bill as a measure to provide and develop our glorious traditions of love, peace, and harmony. These traditions are part of a cultural heritage of which every Indian is justifiably proud. Tolerance for all faiths has characterized our great civilization since time immemorial. These traditions of amity, harmony, and mutual respect came under severe strain during pre-independence period when the colonial power sought to actively create and encourage communal divide in the country. After independence, we have set about healing the wounds of the past and endeavor to restore our traditions of communal amity and goodwill to their past glory. By and large, we have succeeded, although there have been, it must be admitted, some unfortunate setbacks. Rather than being discouraged by such setbacks, it is our duty and commitment to take lessons from them for the future. And then he said, you know, and one of the members said, why is 15th August relevant? But I think this 15th August is crucial, they said, because on that date, we are supposed to emerge as a modern, democratic, and sovereign society, thrusting back such barbarity into the past once and for all. From that date, we have also distinguished ourselves as a state which has no official religion and which gives equal rights to all the different religious denominations. So whatever may have happened before that, we all expect that from that date, there should be no such retrogression into the past. And then the court says, the Places of Worship Act protects and secures the fundamental rights of the Constitution. Talks about the Home Minister's speech, talks about the Advaita philosophy, clearly saying there is no difference between God and ourselves. We have to realize that God is not in the mosque or the temple only, but God is in the heart of every person. And then it says, the Parliament determined that independence of Colonia furnishes the constitutional basis for healing the injustices of the past by providing the confidence to every community, religious community, that their places of worship will be preserved, their character will not be altered. The law addresses itself to the state as much as to every citizen of the nation. Its norms bind those who govern the affairs of the nation at every level. These norms implement the fundamental duties in Article 51A and are hence positive mandates to every citizen as well. The state has, by enacting the law, enforced a constitutional commitment and operationalized its constitutional obligations to uphold the equality of all religions and secularism, which is a part of the basic feature of the Constitution. The Places of Worship Act imposes a non-derogable obligation towards enforcing a commitment to secularism under the Indian Constitution. It is a legislative instrument designed to protect the secular features of the Indian polity, which is one of the basic features of the Constitution. Non-retrogression is a foundational feature of the fundamental constitutional principles of which secularism is a core component. The Places of Worship Act is thus a religious intervention which preserves non-retrogression as an essential feature of our secular values. That's the end of it.
That's very moving, Mr. Panchu. It almost makes you think that the Constitution is on your side, actually.
It is.
But in that case, if the Places of Worship Act and the exception that you make for the Supreme Court made for the Ram Janmabhoomi Babri Masjid, for that complex. Now, if the Places of Worship Act is now part of the basic structure of the Constitution, what are we witnessing today? Why has the Gyanvapi Masjid become such a big controversy, whether or not there was a shivling that was found in some tank or the other? The lower courts are debating something, the Supreme Court is debating something else. So what's going on?
These really, in my view, are non-issues. I'm not talking about the case, I'm not commenting on the case, but any issue like this, which ultimately leads to saying we want to change the character of a place of worship, is forbidden. We have crossed that stage and the law forbids it.
But can I be, so if I have, say that I'm in parliament and my party has a majority in parliament, now why can't I amend the Places of Worship Act, even if it's in the basic structure?
You can't, because it's the basic structure. The basic structure is beyond amendment by parliament. That is the whole purpose of creation of the basic structure. in Keshan Bharati case, we would allow you to amend some fundamental rights, but we will place some things above amendment because those things are fundamental for this country.
So today, if a case like this comes up where, you know, in my local masjid or gurudwara or temple or something or the other, one community says, let's change it. You cannot change it because it is now part of the basic structure, and therefore these places of worship, the character of these places cannot be changed.
Cannot be changed. And I will read one more sentence in this judgment. I'm sorry to make this sound like a law class.
No worries.
Yes. There is a purpose, the court said, underlying the enactment of the Places of Worship Act. The law speaks to our history and to the future of the nation. Cognizant as we are of our history and of the need for the nation to confront it, independence was a watershed moment to heal the wounds of the past. Historical wrongs cannot be remedied by people taking the law in their own hands. Historical wrongs cannot be remedied by the people taking law in their own hands. In preserving the character of place of public worship, Parliament has mandated in no uncertain terms that history and its wrongs shall not be used as instruments to oppress the present and the future. How much better can it be stated?
So if Aurangzeb destroyed a temple 300 years ago...
Yes, it was a historical wrong. It was a historical wrong.
Right.
But we must leave it where it is. We must leave it in history. We cannot bring back history and its wrongs to oppress the present and the future.
So Mr. Panchu, you know that there is a petition in the Varanasi court where the Nandi, which is the sacred bull, where she is facing allegedly the structure, which is allegedly a shivling, which has been, you know, some people say that it has been, it's now in the mosque area. And now there is a petition in front of the local court in Varanasi saying that the wall between the Nandi and this alleged shivling structure should be removed. So you cannot remove that, can you?
You cannot alter the character of the place of worship at all. You cannot alter the character. You cannot seek to change the character and to convert it into the character of another religious denomination.
So if petitions like this come in front of me, I should just throw them out right away.
I completely.
So why am I then, why has this been going on and on? The matter has come right up to the Supreme Court. It's been adjourned a couple of times. Why is it that the justices, the honorable justices, don't just throw it out? It's very simple to me.
I can't comment on what happens in a particular case before the court. You'll have to appreciate that. All I can tell you is that in my view, the law is abundantly clear on the point.
Okay, can I just take you back to your mediation? You were part of this mediation effort on the Ram Janmabhoomi. I know you can't talk about it, but in a sense, what was happening was that whole, the demolition took place in 1992 on the 6th of December, 1992. The Supreme Court judgment came out in 2019, almost 40 years later, or say 37 years later. Now, can I conclude from what happened, which is that the 2.77 acres of disputed land was given to the Hindus in exchange for adding the Places of Worship Act to the basic structure? Can I conclude that this was a bit like a quid pro quo?
I think the court took into account the key concerns of both sides. I think the court took into account very well the key concerns of both sides. I think the court read it very well. And I think the court ultimately came out with a judgment which solved that particular, you know, issue and which laid the ground for harmony in future.
When you say it took into account the key concerns of both sides, what would be the key concerns of, say, the Muslims?
I think the key concerns of the Muslims were really that, is this the first to others? Are we opening the doors on this? And those are the key concerns of Muslims. I mean, I cannot talk about what the deliberations and the discussions.
Sure.
But you can read, you can read anywhere. People have written and spoken with the fear that, you know, is Ram Mandir just the first? Will others follow? Hmm. And I think the court has, you know, brilliantly answered, you know, taken care of those concerns.
So, you know, you're an internationally recognized mediator. What happens in a mediation? You have two equal parties that believe that they are wronged. How do you, you know, in the Ram Janmabhoomi case, you had the Muslim side, which said that the demolition of the masjid was plainly wrong. And then you had the Hindu side, which said, this is our temple to Ram that has been, that we have worshipped for the last 500 years or 400 years, and that it should be returned to us. What happens in a situation like that?
So I will answer this without reference to the mediation, because that is an area where I'm barred from entering.
Sure.
Let me say there is a dispute, even a public dispute, and you have, you know, people, two different sections. It could be anything. It could be water sharing. It could be, you know, any other natural resource. It could be state borders. It could be a place of religion. But the way a mediator will operate, and the first thing, of course, is to be able to get a mediation going. And I think in India, a court is really the institution to start a mediation going. Mm-hmm. People respect a mediation ordered by the courts. And I think basically the task of the mediator is to get parties to realize, firstly, you know, that the mediator is not there to give a decision. Mm-hmm. That these are non-threatening proceedings, that they are confidential, and parties really can stop them at any time they want, so there is no risk to them. They're trying to see whether they can get a solution. And in that process, the mediator really aids communication and understanding. Mm-hmm. Parties initially find it very difficult to speak with each other because they've been, you know, at loggerheads for years. Emotions would have run very high. But if they trust the mediator, they will open up to the mediator. And the mediator will ask them some very fundamental questions, very different from what a court of law would ask. A court of law wants to know what happened in the past. Mm-hmm. A mediator will say, after, of course, getting all the facts, you know, down, the mediator will say, well, what are your long-term interests? Mm-hmm. Now, that doesn't, you know, come... It's not a question you get in a court. In a court, it's all right. I want this piece of land, or I want this river water, or I want this piece of boundary, etc., border. The mediator will say, what are your long-term interests? Mm. What are the long-term interests for you, your community, your people, your state? Go into the future. Go wide. Mm. Widen the perspective. Look at long-term interests. And we'll get that, you know, starting into the conversation. And then the media, I'm simplifying this. Okay, otherwise right. I would have to give you a...
Of course.
And then the mediator would say, well, you know, maybe we can take a look at some parts of your case where you might not be as well off as you think. Hmm. Everybody thinks they're going to win their case because the lawyers have said they're going to win. But a mediator will be able to show people on either side, and he will do this equally, both sides, that look, you are on a sticky wicket here. You may be on a sticky wicket here. Are you quite sure about this particular thing? And then you start people thinking that, look, you know, I may not win, maybe. And then a mediator will say, let's chat about what is the alternative to settlement? If you're not going to settle today, what are you looking at? Hmm. How many more years of litigation are you looking at? How much more years of damage with your adversary? What kind of an inheritance are you going to bequeath to your next generation? Hmm. How long has this gone on? And if you don't settle today, how long is it going to go on? And then the mediator does what is really the most important part of the process. He says, let's have discussions and options for settlement. Right. I want your ideas for how this can be settled. Where is the give and take over here? Where is the trade-off? Hmm. What are your fears and concerns on these things? But what are your suggestions for settlement? That's why I'm here with you, to help you to develop that.
Right.
And when you reach that stage, well, you will start getting ideas for settlement. People will say, you know, I'm willing to do this provided I get this. maybe we can give up this, provided we get this. This is more important to me. On this, I can concede. And that is magic. Because when you've got to that stage, then it's a question of taking up suggestions, working them, reworking them, refining them. And you come to that wonderful stage when the parties, instead of attacking each other, are attacking the problem.
And you saw this magic happen in the Ram Janmabhoomi dispute.
I saw that.
And you felt that there was hope for the future of the two
countries. I felt there was hope for India.
But then what happens, Mr. Panchu, is that, you know, when as time goes on, then feelings of revenge then perhaps come in, not by the two parties that mediated this particular issue, but outside third parties.
I think the court, I'm not saying what should happen, what will happen. Look, this is a huge country. Okay. You can't obviate the fact that there will be people who want to raise bones of contention for their own ends. That's why you have the law, so that you don't have to take each bone of contention and, you know, gnaw it to the bone fully. That's why you have the law which deals with this. And that's why you have an act, as Shankara Chauhan so brilliantly stated in Parliament. This is the purpose of the act. And you can't have a better elucidation of that than this wonderful Ayodhya judgment. I wish people would read this judgment. Read paragraph 78 onwards. I wish people would read it.
Mr. Panchu, the Shankaracharya, who is a Hindu holy man, he's, you know, a lot of people respect him and revere him. He has come out and said that that the Kashi Vishwanath temple is sort of incomplete without the allegedly the shivling that has now been discovered next door in the masjid. And also leaders of the RSS have said that now that this so-called shivling is been discovered, then things change, and that perhaps you can amend this act. But you're saying it's part of the basic structure.
But
what do you do to religious figures who then say that no, this should be part of our...
I have not read the Shankaracharya's statement, and so I can't really comment on it. Maybe he's talking from a purely religious standpoint.
He is.
And hasn't really, appreciated what Parliament and the court has done. So I think one should grant him that. But I do remember, when you're talking about the RSS, I remember Mr. Bhagwat made a very significant statement, which I actually was very happy to hear from him. And I thought that was very statesmanlike.
Mr. Mohan Bhagwat.
Yes. That after the Ayodhya judgment, he said, as far as the RSS is concerned, we are only here for the Ram Mandir. We are not interested in any of the other places. And he made that statement. And I thought that, he has wonderfully sealed the issue. There's a lot of, I think, credit to him for making that statement.
Well, he's made some other statements in the last couple of days, which are not as clear and perhaps...
Which are not as clear. Maybe he should be reminded of the statement.
Yeah, maybe he should be reminded of the statement and where he said that the RSS or the Hindu community is only or was only interested in the Ram Mandir and not interested in any of the other
disciplines. I'll read you a statement. Because of a historical backdrop, the Sangh got associated with this movement, Ayodhya, as an organization. It is an exception. Now we will again be associated with human development, and this movement will not remain of concern to us. He said that. And I thought that was very creditable of him. I was very happy to read that statement from him.
So in a sense, the way you describe it, it's almost like an open and shut case, isn't it?
I think so, yes.
Well, on this note, Mr. Panchu, I hope that the Supreme Court, when it looks at the matter, wherever it does on Friday or in the coming days, I hope it will be reminded of the fact that it's actually very simple, that the Places of Worship Act 1991 elevates itself to the as being part of the basic structure of the Constitution, and you cannot tamper with it.
That's right. Yes.
Thank you so much for your time, for explaining this in such detail and so simply, actually. It's a complex matter, but at the end of it, at the heart of it, it seems quite simple. But thank you so much for your time, Mr. Shriram Panchu, for joining me on The Print.